Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Arizona's tough law aimed at driving illegal immigrants out of the state went before the U.S. Supreme Court this morning. And it appears the court will likely uphold key parts of the law, like the requirement that police check the immigration status of people they stop. But the eight justices who heard the case seem to have doubts about other aspects of the law. The Obama administration argues that federal policy trumps the state law. That's similar to the argument the administration made before the Supreme Court last month on the issue of health care reform. Rulings in both cases are expected by June. This comes as both the Obama and Romney presidential campaigns try to win the crucial swing votes among Latinos and independents. Joining us on the line is George Washington University law professor Jonathan Turley. Jonathan, you've been following this morning's arguments via live blogging. If you're comfortable calling it this early, which way do you think this is going to go?
I'm sure it'll end in some decision. I can say that with great certainty. It does seem like the court is not going to rule with the administration on the complete bar on state authority in the area. It seems that the court accepts that there is concurrent state jurisdiction, meaning that the state and federal government can coexist in this field and that state laws are not preempted. But when we get down into the weeds, the administration could well eke out a partial win. Where the justices appeared to be almost unanimous was on Section 2, dealing with the right of police to inquire as to the legal or illegal status of an individual.
This would make it a state crime to be in Arizona without legal immigration papers.
Well, Section 2B requires the state to check on it, and then there is a provision establishing it as a crime to be without legal immigration papers. That second part is less obvious in terms of where the court will come out. It's clear that they're going to uphold parts of the law, particularly as to inquiring as to status. But the other provisions, particularly the creation of state crimes, there seem to be, according to reports coming out of the court, much more equivocation by the justices. The important thing to remember, Sasha, is that they only need one vote, because Kagan recused herself. And the way the Supreme Court works is that if they tie 4-4, the lower court decision is automatically upheld. Now, the lower court decision in this case was the Ninth Circuit upholding the law. So they just need one conservative vote, which I think they assume would be Kennedy.
Who the blogs say is apparently hard to read on this, based on this morning.
Right. Well, see, Kennedy is in a bit of a bind, because in a case last May called Whiting, the court looked at another Arizona immigration law. And in that opinion, Kennedy signed on with Roberts in saying, Roberts was saying it on his behalf and others, that we don't believe that state law should be easily set aside or preempted. And we have a strong presumption in favor of state law. And many of us read that as a very good position for Arizona going into this argument. So Kennedy has already said that he has a strong presumption. So where we are is that it appears that part of the law is very likely to be upheld. The administration will not get the sweep they wanted. However, when it comes to the criminal components of new crimes, they could eke out a fourth vote, and it does not appear that Kennedy showed his hand as to which way he would go on that.
New crimes, meaning suddenly you would be a criminal if you were in the state and working there without documentation.
That's right. And so this is, we were seeing less clarity than we saw in the health care debate. And so the administration might be able to eke out a partial victory. The important thing to remember also is that this is going to come out around July, so it's going to hit right before the political conventions. And with both candidates vying for the Latino vote, and particularly for Florida, this decision could very well have a determinative effect on the election.
It could.
It's ironic.
Jonathan,
at the anniversary of Bush v. Gore.
Absolutely. Jonathan, we appreciate your time and insight on this. Jonathan Turley is a law professor at George Washington University.
Thank you.
May 1st, which is coming up next week in case you've lost track, is a huge day for many high school seniors around the country. It's the deadline for them to decide which college they plan to attend. And if the current trend continues, a growing number of them will choose not to major in the humanities. Instead of studying literature, philosophy, history, or the arts, a significant percentage will opt to major in fields that give them more marketable job skills. Think computer science, information technology, engineering. Our next guest has written a new book in which he argues that this decline in humanities education is cheating today's students of a rich college experience and education. That's not a new argument, of course, but Andrew Del Banco, an American Studies professor at Columbia University, goes further. In college, what it was, is, and should be, he writes that yes, schools do need to train tomorrow's workers, but he says they should also provide what he calls a rehearsal space for democracy. I asked him to begin with the title of his book and explain what he thought college should be.
Well, my book is an effort to try to distill what I take to be the basic idea of the American college. Now, we should keep in mind we've got about 4,000 institutions in this country that call themselves colleges. So there's a great array, and that's one of the great strengths of our system, in fact, that it isn't a system. But I persist in believing that there are certain basic principles that we ought to keep in mind before we veer too far away from them. One of them is, and this is surprisingly unique to our culture, that young people between adolescence and adulthood should have an opportunity to sort of take a breath, to reflect on who they are, to think about what kind of life they want to shape for themselves. And that implies the opportunity to explore subjects that they may never have encountered before, to find out what they're good at and what they're not so good at, to take risks and fail and not have those failures haunt them for the rest of their lives. These are assumptions that are built into the American idea of college, which is very different from the way in many other cultures people think of preparation for the university, where young people are expected really to know the answers to those questions by the time they arrive at the university.
To basically have picked in advance what their major will be and not have that time of exploration.
Well, even the concept of a major is kind of alien in most countries. A major means what you study all the time in many other countries. In our country, we try to find this balance between what we sometimes call general education and then the choice of major. So the whole emphasis on fluidity and opportunity, which is a very deeply American idea that you can reinvent yourself, you can discover that there's something about yourself you didn't know, that's built into the conception of college, and I would be very unhappy to see that disappear even more completely than it already is.
Professor Del Banco, I don't want to oversimplify the point of your book, but at some level, would you say that your basic argument is that college graduates these days aren't well-rounded enough?
I guess I do resist the soundbite reduction, but well-rounded in the sense that they're forced too early by many, many pressures from their parents, from society at large, from the economic realities, and from the institutions themselves to pick an identity, as it were. This is who I am. This is the vocation or profession that I'm preparing for. In that sense, yes, I would like to see a broader experience in their college years. And to that end, let me mention another very basic principle of the American college, which is fundamentally different, I think, from educational thinking in other countries. And that is that students have something, in fact, a great deal, to learn from one another as well as from their teachers. This is the idea that you join a community because you have something to bring to it. And that idea was present in the 17th century, and it implied a certain kind of diversity, not diversity in the sense that we use it today, no doubt. All the students in the 18th century at New England colleges had more or less the same color skin and similar genealogies. But nevertheless, there was this implicit or incipient idea that in order for a college to be a real learning community, you want students who are different from one another. And that idea persists all the way into our own time. In fact, it underlies Justice Powell's famous decision in the Bakke case back in the 70s that taking into account race as one factor in putting together a college class is legitimate because black people have had one kind of experience, Hispanics have likely had another, Recent immigrants from Asia have had yet another, and it's good to get all those people together so that they can learn from one another. And that's another aspect of the American college that I think we want to protect.
You write in your book that the ideal college education would be a broad humanistic one. What do you think that college students who don't get that lose out on? How do their educations suffer?
There's an enormous amount of talk about college. Politicians are arguing about it. You know, should everybody go or should not everybody go? How do we pay for it? And then, of course, people rush to the newsstand to get the magazine so they can find out what the so-called best colleges are. So there's a lot of talk, but I think there's a certain lack of clarity about what the reasons for this preoccupation are. So the first argument that you hear almost all the time from all points in the political spectrum is the economic argument. And it's a good one. We need an educated population to compete in the global marketplace. For most of the emerging careers in the 21st century, a high school education is not sufficient. But there's a second argument which I think is at every bit as important, which one hears much more rarely, and that is we cannot have a democracy without an educated citizenry. We must have a citizenry that can tell the difference between demagoguery and serious leadership, that can tell the difference between arguments and opinions, one based on evidence, the other based on prejudice or a pre-existing preference for one point of view or another. The ideal college classroom, and this can be anywhere, and I don't like the hierarchical distinctions, but it can be anywhere from a community college to an Ivy League institution. An ideal college classroom is a place where students learn that first they learn to speak civilly to one another, they learn to listen to one another respectfully, and they learn that it's possible that they're going to walk in with one point of view and they're going to walk out with another, or at least with a curiosity about another point of view. Seems to me that's a kind of rehearsal space for democracy. And we need as much of that as we can possibly get. I don't think it matters what your politics are. Most Americans agree that there's something wrong with our politics, that the soundbite culture and the distortions that are out there are intolerable. We need a better educated population. And I think college is a powerful institution if we're going to try to achieve that.
And do you think that college students who focus on business and management, which you are critical of, that narrow focus rather than a more broad humanities focus, do you think they're not getting that kind of rigorous practice of expanded thinking?
Any subject can be taught if there's in such a way that the mind of the student can be enlarged. Science and engineering and mathematics are tremendously important for our competitive position in the world. And I think a citizen today can't really understand the world without some basic grasp of science. But we don't want to lose the opportunity to reflect on the deep philosophical questions that you find in ancient texts. And you don't want to lose the opportunity to get some historical perspective on the present.
That's Columbia University professor Andrew Del Bonco. Go to hereandnow.org to read an excerpt from his new book. When we come back, can a text from 400 years ago shed light on today's foreclosure crisis? And later in the show, struggling democracy in Egypt. Several presidential candidates have been banned from running. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking about higher education and the decline in students studying the humanities. Our guest is Andrew Del Bonco, a professor of American Studies at Columbia University, and the author of the new book, College: What It Was, Is, and Should Be. Del Bonco understands the challenges facing many students and their families. State schools have seen funding cuts, tuition at most schools is out of reach for many people, and huge numbers of students graduate with massive loans. As a result of these pressures, many of them feel they have to study subjects that will help them find jobs. But Del Bonco says literature and history are critical too. He writes about a very early text in American literature, a sermon delivered by the Puritan John Winthrop, that references creditors, debtors, and lenders. Del Bonco says that piece of writing, titled A Model of Christian Charity, can teach today's students a lot.
Here is this sermon, which initially most students would say, my goodness, why do I need to read this? This has nothing to do with my particular religious commitments. It's almost 400 years old. But you find out that this fellow is saying to those who've traveled across the ocean with him, look, we have to figure out what the rules are going to be in this new society. When should one demand payment of a debt? Should one demand it under circumstances where the person owing you the money simply doesn't have it because he or she has been a victim of an economic catastrophe? And Winthrop, like any good Puritan, goes to Scripture to find an answer. And his answer is that you have to be flexible. You have to extend the terms for repayment. Maybe sometimes you even have to forgive the debt altogether. Now, I don't need to point out how relevant those questions are to the present crisis following the massive amount of home mortgage foreclosure. The job of the teacher is not to prescribe the right answer, is not to say, okay, we derive from this text a lesson on how such and such a bank should behave. But it is to point out to students that the questions that we face today are not new, that there are resources in literature and in many different kinds of religious and ethical traditions for thinking about them. You asked earlier about, is it okay for undergraduates to study business? Sure, but I think if they study it with something like that context in mind, that would be a better way to go than purely, how to maximize your retail potential.
There are many people, as you know, who argue that not everyone should go to college, and maybe they shouldn't go to a four-year college, maybe get an associate's degree, maybe go to a trade school, study the automotive industry. Are you arguing that everyone should have some Kant or some Melville or some Dickens on the side, no matter their level of academic ability?
Well, I would say a couple things about that. My sense is that the people who are most vociferous in saying that not everyone should go to college are always talking about somebody else's children. Of course, not everybody is going to go to college, but as an ideal and as a goal, which presumes that a great many more people than we tend to assume are capable of personal growth and self-fulfillment through a study of literature and encounter with ideas and encounter with people different from themselves. In that, I firmly believe, and I think that we tend to shortchange many of our fellow citizens. We tend to try to sort people out by intelligence based on their performance on standardized tests at an early age, and I think that is a very pernicious trend. It's very clear to me from personal experience and from what I've read and witnessed secondhand as well as firsthand that people in all walks of life, including people with long prison sentences, people with terrible histories of drug abuse, can have life-transforming experiences by doing college-level work. So we don't want to become a society that decides that, you know, only the privileged few or only the people beyond a certain cutoff score on the test are entitled to more education. We want to be a society that makes the opportunity for more education as widely available as possible.
If in the end what college graduates most need is jobs, how does this idea of a broad humanistic education assist with that?
Well, I think students are understandably anxious about what they're going to be able to do after college, especially those who are carrying a heavy debt load, and we need desperately to address that problem. But at the same time, I think students and parents tend to shortchange the value of a broad liberal education for the market after college. Many CEOs that I've talked to and people in law firms and people in all kinds of sectors of the business world will tell you they want students who can think for themselves. They want students who can express themselves, who can write well. They want students who have some perspective and some imagination. And those qualities are the ones that a good college should foster and develop. So I don't think there's any contradiction between a broad liberal education and one's prospects in the marketplace after college. On the contrary, I think the fit is a close one.
Although you do seem to think that there's a loss when a student just focuses on marketable skills like, you know, information technology and doesn't come out with a good grounding in the humanities.
Although the key word there is just, right? I mean, there's nothing wrong with a student at a certain point in college deciding, you know, this is something I'd like to try and I need to attain the following skills. I mean, if you want to go to medical school, you've got to take those biology and chemistry courses. But you don't want to do that at the expense of the broader educational experience, not just in the classroom sense, but in all the other respects in which the American college has been a special institution.
So it's really about balance.
Well, balance is one way to put it. I'd like to think of it more as a sort of dynamic combination, because if you educate yourself broadly and you get some perspective on the world, you're going to bring to your narrower focus more energy, more enthusiasm, and more creativity. It's not about let's have a little of this and a little of that so we get the right balance. It's about putting it all together and coming out of college as close as a not as a complete human being, but as a human being who has an appetite for learning that will that he or she will carry forward through the rest of his or her life. That's the kind of employee that every employer I know anything about wants to hire. They want somebody who's going to be curious and interested in learning and getting better at what they're doing, not somebody who thinks of themselves as a peg in a slot.
Andrew DelBanco is the author of College, What It Was, Is, and Should Be. Professor DelBanco, thank you.
Thank you.
Let us know your thoughts on hereandnow.org. Click on Contact Us to send an email. You can also find us on Facebook. News is next. This is Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, and by Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world, extension.harvard.edu, and by the Institute of Contemporary Art Boston with Figuring Color, exploring the expressive power of color in paintings and sculpture, icaboston.org.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A verdict is due tomorrow in the trial of Charles Taylor, the former president of Liberia. If he's convicted of committing atrocities in Sierra Leone, he'll be the first head of state found guilty by an international war crimes tribunal. The BBC's Alan Little looks at Taylor's legacy in Sierra Leone and how the country has progressed since its civil war.
Freetown is still a place of graphic poverty. There's a rubbish dump in the center of town that stretches hundreds of meters into the middle distance. Barefoot children comb it for scraps of plastic they might sell for pennies. A patch of wasteland nearby is still known here as the amputee camp, even though the camp is long gone. In the 1990s, there was a tented settlement here that housed hundreds of men, women and children who'd had limbs chopped off by machete or axe, often by child soldiers. This was the signature atrocity of the rebel force known as the Revolutionary United Front, or RUF. Edward Conte now runs a charity to try to help the thousands of amputees the war bequeathed. He says he once heard Charles Taylor on the radio threatening to make Sierra Leone taste the bitterness of war.
So, if I see Charles Taylor behind bars, I'll be happy until the rest of my life.
I drove out of Freetown and up country to a village I had visited many times before. Yonibana is home to perhaps 4,000. They live mostly in thatched huts of mud brick. They're at last restoring Yonibana's water supply. When it's finished, it'll bring the village back to where it was in the 1970s, a measure of how war retarded development here. But change is coming at last. Chinese money is about to develop Yonibana's fertile but uncultivated soil. There is to be a rubber plantation, a pineapple plantation, rice fields. The Reverend Sulemani Kamara is the son of a former paramount chief in the village.
That will at least help to boost up the economy and even the social status of the people, because we are expecting more people to come. We are expecting over 10,000 employments here.
Has Yonibana seen anything like that in your lifetime?
No. This is the biggest agricultural project, the biggest project in the country so far.
Back in Freetown, we found more evidence still of resource-hungry China's new role here. We stumbled on shift change at a road construction site, supervised by a camera-shy Chinese technician. His local workers were enthusiastic about the Chinese presence here.
Are they doing a good job here?
Very good job, because they trained me up. They are good people.
What did they train you as?
They train me as a surveyor.
And what are they bringing to Sierra Leone? What is their contribution?
They contribute great development in our nation, because this is development, infrastructure. I love that.
And the wheels of industry are turning at last. At Lunsar, bitterly fought over during the war, there's an iron ore mine that fell into dereliction in the 1960s. The London Mining Company has reactivated it. The land here is rich in minerals. No one knows how much there is, but it has the potential to transform this country's fortunes. Sierra Leone has been at peace for a decade now. It has held two successful and transparent elections. 4 years ago, the incumbent government lost and left office, willingly, peacefully, unmolested. There is still widespread corruption and problems abound, but slowly Sierra Leoneans are rebuilding the institutions of democratic accountability. The Information Minister, Ibrahim Ben-Kargbo.
Democracy in this country is very secure. This government came to power after winning the elections. The president came in, he allowed the ministers of the former government to remain in office for about 3 weeks to a month to organize themselves so that the transition could be smooth, and it did happen. And during this period, 4 years, going to 5 years now, quite a number of by-elections have been conducted, and the government won some seats, and they lost some to the opposition, a clear indication that the people were always willing to accept the verdicts of the people.
The Charles Taylor verdict is eagerly awaited on these streets. The trial has been a coming to terms for Sierra Leoneans, a way to make sense of the catastrophe that befell them. It is a milestone on the long journey back from the horrors they lived through.
That report from the BBC's Alan Little. Back in 30 seconds with an update on Egypt's tentative transition to democracy here and now. Welcome back. The ballot for next month's presidential election in Egypt keeps shrinking. This week, Egypt's election commission disqualified another presidential candidate. That means at least 11 candidates have been barred from the voting. A final list of candidates who will be on the ballot is expected tomorrow. Journalist Thanasi Kambanis is following the story. We'll link you to his recent piece in The Atlantic at hereandnow.org. He joins us now. And Thanasi, welcome back to Here and Now.
Great to be with you, Sasha.
Thanasi, the candidate knocked off the ballot this week was Mubarak's prime minister during last year's uprising. Why was he disqualified?
His name was Ahmed Shafiq, and he was also a former Air Force general. He was knocked off in actually a somewhat democratic manner. The parliament passed a new law last week barring figures from the old Mubarak regime from running, and it was very quickly ratified and upheld by the courts, and so he was stricken because of his links to Mubarak. Now, the previous front runners who were kicked off the ballot last week were kicked off by the completely opaque and untransparent Presidential Elections Committee, whose decisions are subject to no appeal at all.
So describe that to us. That apparently is the government body that's making these decisions?
Yes,
who is on this body?
Well, we know some of the names, but they're basically anonymous bureaucrats on the Supreme Presidential Elections Commission. Their rules are somewhat derived from a fiat published a year ago by the ruling generals. So they have no real inherent legal authority, or at least they have a legal authority that's not really legitimate in the popular eye, and there's no appeals court, there's no Supreme Court that can question their decisions. What they did last week was they got rid of all three front runners, two Islamists and one very seedy old regime type, the man named Omar Suleiman, the former vice president who's also tied to the rendition program. And that decision pleased a lot of people for its results because it got rid of the most detested candidates, the most hardcore Islamist, the most popular Muslim Brotherhood leader, and this former regime figure. But few people have really stopped to consider the ramifications of the undemocratic process that's led to it so far.
Thanasi, sometimes when the Western press explains why people were disqualified from the Egypt ballot, it says there were technicalities. But of course, technicalities can be legitimate. Maybe someone didn't get the appropriate number of signatures or paperwork. Are these, in your view, legitimate, or are these weak excuses to knock people off the ballot you don't want on the ballot?
Well, the way I just described this to a colleague earlier today was a culture of fake rule of law, and that's how Egypt has been ruled forever. So essentially, there's a rule for everything, and therefore somebody is always breaking the rules one way or another. If you actually disqualify someone or throw them in prison in a different situation, you can almost always find a real legal justification. When it comes to these presidential candidates, they have to submit tens of thousands of signatures from a very specific mix of provinces around the country, and traditionally fake signatures or forged signatures are the way that people have been thrown out, even under Mubarak's regime, and that was the technicality that was used against one of the candidates. The other technicality was much more political and nefarious, was the real front runner, the Muslim Brotherhood Deputy Supreme Guide Khairat Shatter. He was thrown out because he had been convicted of a crime under Mubarak's regime, and that conviction was a completely political, trumped-up charge that was used against him because he was a dissident in the Mubarak era. So that is, again, technically correct. He was convicted, but he was also pardoned in the last few months, and that's a conviction that should have never happened in the first place.
So not the actions of a healthy emerging democracy.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, what we see here is a process that's really been overshadowed by the unaccountable machinations, first of all, of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, and secondly, and perhaps more disturbingly, by these legions of bureaucrats who wield a lot of power, and we really don't know what their motivations are. I mean, they could be working to serve the interests of the old regime. They could be working for their own political convictions. But one way or another, they really are controlling this process. And one thing that we can't underestimate the risk of is that this entire transition, the presidential election that's coming up next month, the parliament that took office in January, are all actually under threat by a court decision that could come any day, and a lot of people worry about this, that could invalidate the entire process of everything that's happened since last January because there's no basis in law for any of it. And if that happens, and it really there's legal reason that it should, we'd be right back to the day Mubarak resigned, and it's as if nothing had happened.
On the other hand, Thanasi, you've written that at least on the surface, the decision to get rid of some of these candidates will stop some serious shenanigans by the Muslim Brotherhood, the Islamic group. What kind of shenanigans do you mean?
I was referring to shenanigans in general, not just by the Brotherhood. The first and most disturbing one was actually Omar Suleiman, the former spy master, whose entry in the race really threw people into disarray and seemed like a revanchist plot by former regime elements. The second important group of shenanigans are those of the Brotherhood, who have really gone from being pragmatic and constrained to exhibiting a lot of autocratic tendencies and overreach in the last couple of months. A year ago, their position was they wanted to be the sort of holistic, inclusive, Mandela-like force in Egypt's transition. As of last month, they were contesting every office in the land, from president to prime minister, to dominating the Constitution Writing Convention and allowing no minority representation that was meaningful and no veto power against them. They are behaving very much like autocrats in making, and that kind of behavior is something that people were really aghast at, even people who support them, and the disqualification of their leading candidate was viewed as a sort of pruning back of the Brotherhood's most extreme tendencies.
Thanasi, of the candidates left in the presidential race, is there a clear front runner?
Yes, the front runner is probably Amr Moussa, who was the foreign minister under Mubarak and then the head of the Arab League. He's viewed in some quarters as a sort of secular nationalist bulwark against all the chaos and entropy of the transitional period. He's also, it should be noted, a fairly conservative former regime figure. He broke with Mubarak, but he's by no means a liberal reformer. He's a sort of old guard patrician who represents maybe its more restrained tendencies. And the other two front runners are both Islamists. One of them is the head of the Muslim Brotherhood's political party. His name is Mohamed Morsi, and he's quite a fire and brimstone sort of hardline Islamist. And the third contender is viewed as a bridge. He's a man named Abdelmonem Abou El Foutou. He's a former Brotherhood man, a doctor who tries to portray himself as a secular liberal Islamist.
That's journalist Thanasi Kambanis. There's a link to his work at hereandnow.org. And Thanasi, I understand you're working on a new book about the revolution in Egypt and the effort to build a new democracy there?
I am. I'm heading back on Tuesday to cover the presidential race.
Thanasi, thanks for making time to talk with us.
Great to be with you.
This is Here and Now. The publishing world has moved on from indignation to optimism after the Pulitzer Board failed to award a prize in fiction this year. The panel couldn't agree on which book to choose. Swamplandia by Karen Russell, The Pale King by the late David Foster Wallace, which was completed by his editor, or Train Dreams by Dennis Johnson. After a period of collective outrage, publishers are now saying that maybe the non-award is a good thing. Their rationale is that all three finalists will get a boost from the publicity. Steve Almond is our literary critic, and he has yet a different take. He says it's ridiculous to even try to judge winners and losers in art. And Steve is with us to talk more about that. Hi, Steve.
Hi.
So, Steve, first, give us your take on this controversy and why you think the award really shouldn't matter that much.
Well, this actually applies to the Grammys and even to some extent to the Oscars. Everybody goes into a movie theater or picks up a book or listens to a song and they have a different experience. And it's a human experience. It's not a box score. This isn't a game that people are playing. They have a very complicated way that the art interacts with their own emotional lives. And to try to reduce that in this typically American way to, you know, who won and who lost is just silly.
Although it's not just American, in some ways it's human nature to want to say who's first, who's second, who's third.
Well, yeah, but we have like five or six of these. We've got the National Book Award, the National Book Critics Circle Award, and the LA Times Award, and the Story Prize, and the Penn Hemingway, and the Pulitzer. Yeah, they have the Man and the Booker over in England, and the Orange Prize as well, but we're like the capital of this way of keeping score. It's like late model capitalism has to say who's the winner, who's the loser, which is the commodity you should value.
So for those who aren't familiar with how this winnowing down process in the Pulitzer works, give us the quick thumbnail of how we get from several hundred nominees to three finalists.
Right. Well, three people are chosen. In this case, it was a novelist and a couple of very good book critics were chosen to read like 300 books, all the great books of fiction that came out. And they winnowed those down, God knows how, to lots of caffeine probably, and they love to read, down to three finalists. Those finalists were then handed to a board of 18 people who are on the Pulitzer board. The catch is that the majority of them have to agree that one of those three books is the best. And the problem with that, Sasha, obviously, is the books are very different, and they have probably, these readers have a different take on each of them. What if six of them say, this one, Pale King, was the best, this one, Swamplandia, was the best? Then there's no winner unless 10 of the 18 can agree that one book was, quote unquote, the best, whatever that means.
And we should note here that the Pulitzer board or the Pulitzer sort of body defended itself basically by saying this isn't meant to be a statement about fiction in general. It's just a statement that no one was able to receive a majority.
Right. But that process, in other words, if you're going to make these three people read 300 books and, you know, find what they feel are the three best, it just makes sense to do maybe what they do like in parliamentary elections, just rank them 1, 2, 3, and whoever gets the best score wins. There are lots of easy ways that they could have avoided this controversy. That being said, here we are talking about those books. To me, what's interesting about these contests, Sasha, about all of them, is not the winner or loser. It's the deliberations. The most fascinating thing you could do with all these contests is to have a transcript of the conversation that these people have. Because that way, anyway, they'd be talking about the books rather than saying, book A wins for whatever mysterious reason.
Steve Almond, in many ways, you say Pulitzer, overrated. But Ann Patchett, big-name author, bel canto, state of wonder, she recently opened a brick-and-mortar bookstore herself, I think down in Louisiana. She wrote in a New York Times op-ed that the publishing industry needs this award now more than ever because book sales are faltering, and it injects excitement and probably spurs book sales.
Well, I think the controversy will spur more book sales than having declared a winner. And here we are talking about three works of literature. However, tangentially, we were talking about those books. We're mentioning them. I am exhorting everybody to go out and find them. And by the way, the articles that have been written about this brouhaha have managed to mention a bunch of other great books. My favorite book of the year was Edith Perlman's Binocular Vision, which was a brilliant, breathtaking, amazing book of stories that wasn't even in the final three.
Right, and Ann Patchett's op-ed was basically a great reading list of suggested
books. That's exactly right. So she now has the pretext to talk about literature, but even more interesting for me would be to get smart people talking about books, to actually be talking about what David Foster Wallace is doing when he discusses the nature of boredom and bureaucracy and modern consciousness, or Karen Russell's amazingly inventive way of sort of gently pointing to the surrealism of the fact that the state of Florida exists in the first place in her wonderful novel Swamplandia. That's what I want to hear about, the actual literature, not the kerfuffle around who won and who lost.
Steve, you recently took part in an interesting exercise meant to test the credibility and lasting power of awards. You re-judged the 1960 National Book Award. Tell us how that came about and what it was meant to do.
Well, my friend Michael Griffith, who's a wonderful writer, had this great idea. He said, well, why don't we go back and look what sort of history has had to say about the books that won the National Book Award. And the first year was 1960. We looked at all the books. What won was Goodbye Columbus, a book, a novella and book of stories
by Philip Roth,
his first book. Wonderful book. But also under consideration that year was a wonderful Grace Paley collection, as well as Henderson the Rain King by Saul Bellow and Mrs. Bridge by Evan S. Cannell. Now, he had five writers basically write in praise of the book that they thought should have won, and then we all voted, and we voted overwhelmingly for Mrs. Bridge to win or Henderson the Rain King, because both of those are sensational, remarkable novels. And what we did, rather than just having a vote, is we wrote long essays about why those are special pieces of work, and the manner in which those authors have used the English language to transmit their love for those characters to readers. And that's the kind of useful discussion you can have around these award ceremonies, not the box score, but the actual play-by-play of what art does to us.
So a half century later, you came up with a different winner from the same pool of entrants.
And frankly, most people did. You know, if you ask most serious readers, whatever that means, hey, you know, here's a list of books. Which of these books do you think is really the most important in terms of the enduring, you know, emotional and psychological work it does, and moral work, people would probably say, oh yeah, Henderson the Rain King and Mrs. Bridge are head and shoulders above Goodbye Columbus. That's not to say that Goodbye Columbus isn't a great book, but it's not as good as his later novels. It's sort of an apprentice work, and that's understood by readers at this point.
So you think looking back on this Philip Roth work from long ago, we now realize it really wasn't among his best because he's written so much better since.
Well, also just that it's a great book for what it is, but there were great works too, demonstrably, no one would argue, great books published in that year that stand the mark of time, that will speak to the generations as long as people are around reading. And there were, you know, other books and that were very, very good books, but that don't rise to that level. Having said that, maybe some listeners saying Goodbye Columbus is my favorite book in the world, and I don't argue with that. To me, the interesting thing is the discussion, not the winner.
Although, as you just said, Steve, you said demonstrably no one would argue they're among the best.
Right.
But as you said, reading is subjective. So
that was nonsense. I was just saying that because I thought those other books were the best. But, you know, it's okay to have opinions. What I want to see is people having a conversation about what they love about particular books. I won't because I know it's not the forum for it, but I could go into a rhapsody about the beautiful sentences and the kind of emotional human work that Saul Bellow is doing in Henderson the Rain King, or that Grace Paley is doing in Little Disturbances of Man, or that Philip Roth is doing in Goodbye Columbus. And that wouldn't be to say one is better than the other. That would be to say they're all remarkable. Sit down. Put your device away. Read.
Although in the end, Steve Ahmed, if you were to win one of these big awards, do you
I would, of course, completely reverse course and say, no, I would be even more interested, because as a hardcore narcissist, I would say, not only did I win, but I want everybody to tell people why I won.
Steve Ahmed is our literary critic. His most recent book is God Bless America. You can go to hereandnow.org to read his essay on why he thought Mrs. Bridge by Evan Cannell should have won the 1960 National Book Award. Steve, thank you.
Absolutely. I just want to note for all of my legion of fans out there that unfortunately God Bless America also did not win the Pulitzer this year.
Well, there's people and more people. What do they know? Man, baby, pays the thrills, the bills, the pills that kill.